Welcome back to the Fifth Estate podcast. In this week's episode, recorded live at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne on Tuesday, April 17th, 2018, host Sally Warhaft is joined by Darren Hinch.
And he is, of course, a Victorian senator in the federal parliament, the founder of the Justice Party. Before becoming a poly, Darren meddled in journalism and broadcasting. He was a newspaper editor and, of course, is somebody whose voice and opinions have been with us for many decades now.
Forever.
Forever. He's the author of 14 books and his latest book is Hinch versus Canberra. Behind the human headlines. Please give him a big, warm Wheeler welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
I really enjoyed so much about this book, but starting from holding it in my hands, as a book lover, not every book actually feels good in your hands, right. And this one does. I like the little format. I like you can tuck it in your bag and take it with you. I don't normally begin by discussing the title and the front cover because often it's a giveaway as an interviewer that you might not have read it.
True.
But I have read it. This photo, you won't be able to see it from here, but have a look down the end, buy a copy, is Darren standing...
It's my Johnny Cash moment. Yeah, it is my Johnny Cash moment. It's actually, that was taken just after the last time I was in jail. That's by Langi Kau Kau Prison. And the photographer is my ex-girlfriend. And she took it and said, get up on the track and go for a walk. And it was broken down old station. And I said, oh, I don't want to do that. And she said, believe me, it'll work. And when we took that photo 3 or 4 years ago, and when Louise Adler said, well, I've got an idea for this book, Hinch versus Canberra, I thought, that's the picture I want. And unfortunately, it makes it look like I did it all by myself, and I didn't. It's not a one-man band.
Well, it's a slightly disturbing shot, so have a look at it up close. It looks like the train's on the way and you're really thinking about staying there.
That's like Canberra.
Which gets me to my next point, Hinch versus Canberra. Is it a war? Is it that adversarial?
It can be, and it is at times. If somebody said to me when I first got there how collegiate the Senate is, I would have thrown up. I mean, George Brandis kept telling me, oh, this is so collegiate, you know. We don't even refer to the House of Reps as the House of Reps. In the chamber, you refer to it as the other place.
Yes.
So it says that. It's the other place. It's that sort of leftover bit from the House of Lords. So the Senate is meant to be, it is the House of Review, and we're not, although Paul Keating said we're unrepresentative swill. I don't think it's quite to that stage. I have my doubts sometimes. But it is, look, it is fascinating. It is an amazing thing. You can't see this, but one thing I carry in my pocket all the time when I got there, the usher of the Black Rod, the usher of the Black Rod called me in and gave me this. It's a gold-plated, heavy-plated gold.
There's a photo in the book of you holding this.
In the
this.
Old days, when only men were in the Senate, you wore it on your fob pocket, and it got you free rides on the train. I don't think it'd work on Mikey, but it does give you free rides. So you got free rides on the trains in the old days. But it's that sort of grandeur is still there to a degree.
Yeah. And are you a bit charmed by that?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, look, I got that sense.
It's an honour. I mean, to be a senator, there's only been about 700 of us all ever. I think I'm right in saying that more
571,
More men have worn the baggy green than men and women have been elected to the Senate.
Yep.
And so you think, it's extraordinary. I was in the Solomon Islands recently with Save the Children, and Julian, the former St Kilda mayor, Julian Hill, he was there, and somebody, one of the local premiers in the Solomon Islands, said to him, oh, so how big's your electorate? And he said, oh, I represent 100,000 people. And he said to me, and how big's your electorate? And I said, 6,300,000, because that is it. That's what you represent. Yeah. And even though most of you didn't vote for me, that's what you have to do. And I know it's awful to say to you, because we've talked briefly before, but even though you have your special issues, we campaign on about 7 different things. I'm not going to be that political, but they are the things we're passionate about, and at the moment, you know, live exports and stuff. But you still got to be across everything because you have to vote on Gonski. You have to vote on company tax, and the pressure at the moment is very heavy on that. So you've got to be across everything. And I know I sound like a politician saying it's much more work than I thought, but it is, because you just got to, you've got to, in the end, you've got to put your hand up and say, okay, I'm voting this way.
There's a warmth in the book which did surprise me a little bit.
Well, I don't eat babies for breakfast.
No. A real warmth about you. You start with a sort of character assessment of the main players, and as I went to sort of start reading, I was thinking, well, I don't know whether I'd want to be on this list.
Can I tell you how that happened? Louise Adler, who's brilliant, right? And I'm in Toorak. How this book came about, I'm in Toorak, I've got a handful of shirts just back from Canberra, I'm trying to flag an Uber and find him, and she yells out, hey, I want you to write a book. And I said, send me an email. I shouted my email address. And that night she sent me an email and said, I want you to write a book. And I said, well, you mean Hinge versus Canberra? She said, well, now we've got a title. I thought, we're not going to get one, because she said, I just don't want your crikey columns. I want more. And I said, well, I can't. When's your deadline? She's like, 6 weeks. And I said, well, I can't do it. I've got work to do. But so I sat down at a coffee shop and went to say, look, forget about it. And she's a very persuasive. I've been Adlerized, as I could say. And you walk away from there, and I've done a deal for 3 books over the next 7 years, right? And so I said, what I'll do, I'll put a top and a tail on it. I'll do a big, what are my impressions, and then I'll talk about next year and stuff as well. And I'm sitting, I went off for a week. I'm not one of those writers who believe you don't have a view. I like writing with a view. So I went and rented an Airbnb at McMahon's Point in Sydney with the Opera House in the harbour there, and look out the window, and I'm typing away, and Louise sent me a note saying, how about we do it like a cast of characters to start it, so to set the scene? And I said, well, you mean like the good, the bad and the ugly? And she said, exactly. So, well, there we go. And that's what it is, the good, the bad and the ugly.
Really helpful map, you know, to then, because you're not sort of trying to second guess as you get into the, you know.
And you say, well, this is what he thinks of so-and-so.
Yeah, and, but, I mean, really, really fair appraisals. Christopher Pine, sadly, is the only one who comes out.
Christopher Pine, yes. We're an election-winning machine. You know, they won by one seat. And there's an election, the Liberals' election-winning machine. I did say I think there's less to him than meets the eye. I did do that. And I was a bit cruel to Pauline Hanson.
Yes, true.
There is a quote, I won't apply it to Pauline, but there's a quote about somebody else. They said, you could wade through the deepest recesses of his mind and not get your feet wet.
Is it harder to get a straight answer as a broadcaster out of a politician than it is to get a straight answer as a politician out of another one?
No, it's a bit the same, actually. And I think people are getting really sick of it. This sounds really tired now, but just as sometimes, now, as a politician, I sit watching Sky by the hour, and it's just words and words and words. And you think, if only sometimes I'd come out and, I mean, if the opposition would say, that's a great idea. I mean, if the, say, the idea of finally getting a rail link from Tullamarine to Melbourne, if Bill Shorten said, what a brilliant idea, let's go for it and we'll back you, rather than, I know you're the opposition, and it'd be antagonistic. And Tony Abbott was brilliant at that when he was in opposition. But I just think if we wasn't always that antagonistic, if somebody say, yeah, that's a good idea. I mean, I have a funny time with, and so ironically, I'm agreeing with Richard Di Natale on the ABC tonight because I agree with him on legalising cannabis. But I said to him one day, I said, you know, Richard, I want to make a movie about you guys, and I'm going to call it A Bridge Too Far. Because we get what we call the REDS, the notices of motion come through every night, and you go through it with your staff and you look at what it is and then take it to the WHIPS meeting and see where people are going with it. And often you say no position while you think about it overnight. And I said, because I look at your clauses, and clause one, I think, yeah, that's common sense. Clause two, that's fantastic. Yeah. Clause three, I reckon I could wear that in a pinch. Clause four, you must be effing joking. You know? And they just go too far. And some of their ideas are great, some of them are not so great.
I mean, you admire their attempts for transparency.
Yes.
You write in the book.
But then, okay, transparency. This is a green story for you. Transparency. During Gonski 2 last year, which was one of the big successes for the people, some people don't like it and Catholic schools don't like it, but it's a fairer system than we've had for a long time. I put up half a dozen amendments that all got through to improve Gonski. Every one of those amendments that I put up was given to me, worked out with me, with Richard Di Natale and Sarah Hanson-Young. And the Greens worked hard on it, and they were very clever about the way they wanted to do it and make it look better. And then the amendments scub up, and the Greens voted against them all because the Education Union wouldn't like it. So I'm putting up their amendments that they can then save face by voting against. You think, well, that's just madness.
And how frustrating is that? Like, I mean, when you think about the problems that need to be solved in this country, I've referred to this before at a Fit the State. We had Gareth Evans on last year, and he is really concerned, as am I, about the future of work, that there just isn't enough attention being paid on how it's going to change. It's just a big mystery to everybody about
this automation, robots,
yeah,
all this stuff.
Yeah, about, you know, how do you prepare for that? How do you? And I've got a quote from his book, and I asked him about it, and I'd like your thoughts on it, because he says, when it comes to employment, policymakers have to recognise that the whole future of work is genuinely at risk. Solving the challenges of enterprise, the future of work, and the growing inequality is going to require intelligence and ingenuity on a scale and of a quality that we have never seen before from Australian political and economic leaders. And then he adds, even during the golden years that he was, you know, involved.
Obama.
but you know, and he's.
The problem there. The problem there is that most of us, I think, looking back there, most of us are of an age that can't grasp that properly. That robots and automation and streamlining of work hours and cutting back of work hours. I think, and I'm in that category, you know, that it's hard to grasp that that is where it's going to go.
And but that's the job, isn't it?
Yes, but I think, I don't think we have any, I mean, I know we had the Prime Minister recently grabbed on the word of innovation, that was going to be the buzzword, and that sort of disappeared now.
I haven't heard him utter that for about 6 months.
Or a year. No. Mm. So I think that is, Evans is right. I didn't agree with a lot of things, Gareth, but... Yeah, it's a huge problem.
So when you...
And I've answered nothing there, I know.
Well, let me put it another way. Are there people in Canberra who are really working at the... really deeply trying to think through these problems, or is there never time or space?
There is... Well, you hope they've got public servants who are doing... I've got to curb myself because I had a running gag for years as why public servants weren't allowed to look out the window in the morning, because they have nothing to do in the afternoon. But then we
you
have to use...
You can't tell that anymore,
no. No, you're now. And look, I mean, fine, the Parliamentary Library, the staff there are amazing. I mean, the size of it. See, you have access to information. You all have access to information quite amazingly. But I think that most... See, with governments right now, especially federal governments, have 4-year terms in most states, but it's a 3-year term. Only just. The first year you're just settling in. The second year maybe you're governing. The third year you're worrying about getting re-elected. Now, I think that's wrong. I think set 4-year terms are probably a very good idea, because you would have 2 solid years in the middle of it to lock yourself in on policy and what we're really going to try and achieve. I mean, you've got the current Malcolm Turnbull. He needs a good media person. I know Barnaby lost his media person for a variety of reasons, and he messed it up then. I mean, the fact that Marty Joyce is there with a tea towel over his shoulder, whoever told him to do that was mad. Who would have let the Prime Minister be seen in a kayak with a paddle the day before the 30th poll? Mm. Wouldn't somebody say, not a good look, Malcolm, let's just, can we leave that today, you know? And well, then he got himself so tied up in knots after he did You're the Voice. You know, he could, forgot the words at the Commonwealth Games. And he goes in to Neil Mitchell, and he's all ready. And Mitchell says, you want to recite You're the Voice? And the PM says, no, but I've got a good idea for the Treasurer, because there's a line in that song that goes, and he could remember it. Mm-hmm. He could, and he's saying, something to do with battle. He didn't have a clue, you know. I know, oh, dear. It was just, you know. I'm sitting at home screaming, we've got to make ends meet before you get much older. You know, that's the, having been in the You're the Voice soundtrack, I can, with John Farnham, I remember the words very well. So there you go.
You never know whether they're overthinking or just underthinking these sorts of problems.
But well, and then there's the other side, the overspinning of stuff. You know? Mm. But getting back to the point you're making, I think they're so busy getting the day done today. And you watch the opposition and you hear, saying, okay, what's their bullet points for today? And they'll have like three or four words. And then everybody, whether it's Tanya Plibersek or whether it's Albanese, they'll all come out with the same line. That's the line. And one of the Labor ministers left the bullet points in the men's toilet recently. So the journos all have them there for the day. You know. I did do a cruel one about Bill Shorten once, and it wasn't original. It was, I think it was first used to describe Ed Miliband during the British election. And somebody said, how can you believe a word he says when his own face doesn't believe him?
When you started, 7 weeks in, you managed to change the legislation on photos in the Senate.
Yeah.
Which previously it was different rule, weirdly, to the House of Representatives, and you weren't allowed to take photos, now you are. Which I thought was a terrific... It's a small thing, but it's a really big thing.
Well, I guess it's coming out as a journal. The press have been trying to do it for 20 years. Paul Barry reckons that I did this on purpose. I fell asleep during the first day of Parliament and I got photographed asleep and I got done. And he said that was a trap because normally you could not have run a photo of a person in the Senate asleep, because if you could only take photographs in the Senate if somebody had the call.
Yes.
So if you're on your feet and you're talking. But what they were missing out on, and this is what I kept pushing, was that moments of history. So when you got like a minister huddling in the corner with an ex-Xenophon trying to convince him to do something or vote some way, you had that all the time in the House of Reps. We didn't have it. And so I managed to convince them, although I must confess that... there's a bit of chicanery went on because Stephen Parry was the president at the time and he supported my motion to have the rules changed. But all you needed was one senator to say no and it couldn't be done. That's the way the rules work. And Stephen Conroy for years had... He had blocked it for years because apparently he's once caught playing Candy Crush, I think, from somebody photographing him behind him, and he was very toey about that. And I knew that...
It was the argument, he used the argument that people would be able to see what you were...
But that is, in the House, that's banned. You cannot take photographs of something on somebody's desk or papers. The same way a Channel 9 reporter was banned because he took the camera crew took a photo of Michaela Cash's phone. Mm. Now, you've got to have some privacy to be able to run your business. But anyway, I knew that we could get... I thought we could get this through to have the ban lifted on photography. But I knew that... a Senator Burston, One Nation Senator, who hates me. I don't know why. He called himself Professor. Anyway, I knew that the One Nation would block it, I thought. So, but Pauline and her team rarely turn up in the Senate. They miss a lot. And so I figured by about noon they wouldn't be in there in the chamber. And so I tipped off Stephen Parry. I was going to move this motion early. And we got up, moved the motion, passed on the voices, bang, done, and gone. So,
do you love all that? The sneaking around and the,
I love that bit, But look, the funny thing was, Tony Jones once said to me, I was doing Q&A just after I just got elected, and I remember saying to him, he said, I'm so envious. I said, why? He said, well, you really are an insider now. You are on the inside. And I thought, having watched, with respect to the ABC, the Insiders now, which I watch every week, it's the most misnamed show on television. They know nothing about what's on the inside. But that 7 weeks was one thing. But the best thing, there's two things I have achieved. This sounds boastful, but one was in 7 months, I went from introducing a ban on convicted sex offenders travelling overseas on these child rape holidays. In 7 months, it became law. Yep. And both the Prime Minister and Tanya Plibersek, when it was done, they said to me, we thought it would have been done already. And I said, well, you've been here all these years. Why wasn't it? And in fairness to the PM, he said, you know, Darren, sometimes it just takes a fresh pair of eyes. Mm. I think that's true because ministers change. We had five ministers of Veterans Affairs in about 7 months. People, stuff moves from department to department. Then somebody forgets about it. And the one of the commonest things, most common things in Canberra are the three Ds. And the three Ds in Canberra are delay, delay, delete. Mm. Mm. And you watch it and you see it again and again, you know. But we got that through in 7 months. And on December the 2nd, I was in my apartment in Melbourne, got a phone call from the PM saying, Darren, I just want you to know that the first one got turned back at the airport today. And I said, yeah, we've achieved something. And since then, according to Peter Dutton, I think 13 have been turned back in this year so far.
This was an issue in... Yeah.
Thank you. Mm. Could I... I don't know if I still have this. I probably don't have something... Look, no, it's not there. I actually usually carry it with me, but I, on the day I was first made my first speech...
Your pockets are becoming a great mystery to me, Darren.
I haven't got it with me, but I... Michael Rowlands was the MC, and I'm suddenly senator-elect, and all my colleagues are suddenly saying, hey, senator, and it all sounded very strange to them and to me.
Yeah.
And he said, on my way here, he said, Rachel Griffith, you know who? I said, yeah, I've done it for years. He said, well, she knew I was meeting you, so she scribbled this note, which I usually carry with me. And in it, she'd said, Darren, glad you're still alive. But then she said, can you, why is this so? And it was a letter she wrote and scribbled in hand that said, how come if you're bankrupt, you can't go travel overseas for 7 years, but if you're a convicted sex offender, you can? And I read this out as I walked up to the stage and I read it and I said, that can't be true. But if it is, I'll find out. And so every time then in the next 7 months as a newbie, whenever I met up with the Justice Minister or the Foreign Affairs Minister or the Prime Minister, I said, what are we doing about this?
Yep.
What are we doing about this? And so you can achieve stuff. It can happen, you know. And the second one was... There's a thing called transvaginal mesh, which is a massive scandal in this country. And I made a speech to the Senate about it. And I said it would be the biggest medical scandal for women since thalidomide. Since then, I've talked to the thalidomide people in London who say it's worse than thalidomide. And I managed to get a committee hearing up about it, a committee, and we had public hearings around Australia. And then only 2 weeks ago, I brought in probably the most savage independent report saying that mesh must only be used on women as a last resort. And we think probably 15,000 women have been affected badly by it. And on some occasions, doctors have used this mesh when there have been inducements and they've had freebies and trips and stuff. It still is a huge scandal. I won't go into details because there's hundreds of lawsuits against places like J&J around the world, one in Sydney at the moment.
Now, that was an issue that came onto your agenda, though, wasn't it? It wasn't one of the main things that the first policy you just talked about was something you've obviously campaigned about for years, and it was part of your campaign.
Well, the mesh came up. I got an email from a woman from Perth, and she said, I've got to see you about this, Darren. And I said, I vaguely heard a story about this some years ago, so I sort of know what you're talking about. And I said, but I'm just about to go overseas. She said, I can be there tomorrow. And she flew from Perth overnight. Another woman, Kim, flew from came to Adelaide and then across. And then I met up with a young woman in Sydney, and she's perched on the edge of her chair very uncomfortably. And I said to her, can I get you a taxi home to Cronulla? And she said, and she's 29, and she said, no, I'd rather take the train because I can stand up all the way.
Mm.
And you think, this is wrong. And we had women at the hearings, and I remember one doctor was being a real smart ass, and I said, you've sat there giving evidence for 45 minutes. I've had women in that chair who couldn't sit for more than 20 minutes and then went and lay on the ground. And you're giving this just rubbish to me about how this is wonderful breakthrough, you know.
Has it surprised you of the issues that you thought would be, you know, the ones that would carry through? What's sort of dropped away and what's come in?
Well, the live exports roared back in now, and since 60 Minutes 10 days ago, and I've launched a petition, and I've got 82,000 signatures. I want to have 100,000 to take back to the Agriculture Minister. I think the government, I'm trying to get live exports banned. I first took
and
my...
And you have for a long time.
Well, since I took my first petition to Canberra in 1981, I think it was, when Peter Nixon was the primary industry minister. We had 30,000 signatures from people at 3AW, and that's pre social media. Mm. And after 40,000 sheep had died off the west coast in Fremantle, I think we're closer to it than talk about John Farnham's songs. I said the PM had his trouble with You're the Voice. My new one now is This Time I'm Playing to Win. I think we can win this because Barnyard Barnaby's gone, so we can have the new Little Proud, the new agriculture minister. He has actually said things like directors should be fined or jailed. No agriculture minister has ever said that sort of stuff in Australia in decades. Now, the Labor Party, the government was wrong, and I supported them, but they were wrong. When they, after the Four Corners story, they brought in the instant ban, and looking back on it now, I think that probably caused some animal cruelty because nobody knew what was happening. Animals were in holding pens, and that's why the new motion that I'm working on with the Greens is to say that it should be phased in over 3 years. When tanning clinics were suddenly found to be cancerous, we phased them in and phased them out in a couple of years. So if we did it over 3 years, but the minute the law comes in, no expanded markets. So the Cambodian, Japanese, Indonesian markets could not expand, and Gina Rinehart can't take 800,000 more live cattle to China in 2020. So I think if we can get this along, we might get it through. And I remember when Lynn White from Animals Australia, when the first ban came in, I said to her, don't pop the champagne corks, it's going to come back in, and within 6 weeks it did. But the industry itself, for decades, they've got themselves to blame, because every time we have a big blow-up and they make headlines, and then some of us would have a petition or something like that, and then they'd just go away again, and then a few years later the next one would come up again. So I was during 2016, during the election, I was in Townsville, and Bill Shorten was there promising $100 million for a new stadium. So Malcolm Turnbull was there 2 days later, and he offered $100 million for a new stadium. And I said, why don't you take the $100 million and use it on the Townsville abattoir, reboot it as the biggest frozen food abattoir in Australia. All those poor bastards who got screwed by Clive Palmer can come across from Queensland Nickel and work there, or even start one down in Gippsland or Portland, something to do it here. Mm. Because New Zealand banned live exports 30 years ago, 30, 40 years ago. Brazil's just banned live exports. They're one of the biggest, meat, like Argentina, big meat country. Israel just banned it recently. So I think the time has come, but it's going to be hard, but we'll get there, I hope.
How are you going on the organ donation registry, which is my father's an organ donor, and it's something I've never understood why there's not an opt-out.
Well, okay. I wrote a book, A Human Deadline, when I was told I had 12 months to live and had cancer. And that was about having the transplant and whatever. And in there's a chapter about opt-out, because following the Spanish line. I've now actually changed my idea. I think we should have what I call opt-in plus, which is because even with opt-out in Spain, if the family doesn't want it, it doesn't happen. Opt-in plus is like a living will. I think that if you sign on the organ donor register, then that is it. If you're an adult, that is it. Unfortunately now, about 40% of people who are on the register don't get transplanted if they wanted to be, because their family, in their grief, understandably, say no. And usually when organs are perfect to be donated, it's usually a shock death. It's not like a long lingering thing, so you're not used to it. And you imagine if you've got a 9-year-old daughter and you send her off to school, and 12 hours later you're in an emergency room because of some dreadful tragedy, and somebody's saying, could we have your daughter's lungs? So I can understand that. I think about 5 or 6 states in the US have actually done this, and I'm still passionate about it. I know I got in trouble recently. I said I still have a social drink occasionally, and I think my organ donor wouldn't mind. I've took some flack for that. But I remember keep one thing in mind. A year before I had my transplant, I was told I was probably going to die. I said to my doctors, can I just go to New York one more time? And they said no. And then they agreed that if I could, as long as I flew in one of the lie-down beds in business class, and as long as I went straight to the repat from the airport on the way home 5 days later, which I did. And the only time I suddenly felt I might die was that I was going back towards Kennedy Airport and look back over the New York skyline and thought, oh, geez, I may never see that again. But a year after I was transplanted, I went back to Pittsburgh and met the man who invented liver transplants 50 years ago. And after we had a chat and lunch and whatever, and that night I got an email from him, and he said, Darren, it was an honour to meet you. I thought, that can't be right. he said, it was an honour to meet you and to see in you the international ripples of my crazy dream from 50 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and his first 7 patients all died, and they're all children.
Yeah.
And he was regarded as he should have had a Nobel Prize, but he didn't. And he was, that was extraordinary.
My dad was a living donor, by the way. I should add, it was a kidney. Just realised I.
And that is a good thing with the living donors now. They don't get the credit that they deserve.
It's the most amazing thing I've ever seen. What he did, and it wasn't that big a deal actually, but what it did for his stepson was
Well, my donor's mother, Heath Gardner, his name was. My donor's mother's mother was one of the first ever donors in Victoria.
Mm.
So she'd donated organs when she died.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, I remember reading about that.
Yeah, so it's very sweet. So anyway, we're trying to get 1 million more donors, but I had the most awful figure, and I shouldn't say this to you because it may turn you off being a donor, but out of 1 million more people on the register, that will only result in 12 more people donating their organs, which could be 80 more people if it's 5 or 6 or 7 people per donor. Because when you work out how many, about 170,000 people die a year in Australia, and you take it down from where they die and how they die, and it comes down fewer and fewer. And I get angry. Donate Life sacked me as an ambassador because when I was going for opt-out, so I was an ambassador and they sacked me. But they always talk in percentages and say, oh, isn't it fantastic? The percentage of donors has increased by 30%, 40%. It's still down. It's a disgrace. Mm. In Australia, less than 500 people a year nationally donate their organs.
Yep.
That's it. And my surgeon, Bob Jones, Professor Bob Jones, who I hold in absolute awe, he said, I could do 50 more liver transplants a year if I could get the organs. And when they have the transplant games down here, and we all 300 of us gathered in Federation Square, we formed a figure of like 3,824, and that was the number of added years of life that the 300 of us had.
Mm.
And that's when you think, holy, this is something, you know. Mm-hmm. And I've met people now who've been transplanted 23 years ago.
Yeah. One of the things that story you've just told demonstrates, and it's throughout the book as well, is your capacity to change your mind, whether it's on Sunday penalty rates or various things. Is this something that...
It's unusual in Canberra, I tell you.
Well, I was going to say, and is it something that Canberra has made you better at? Or,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Darren Hinch listens. Something I'm not very good at. Haven't been very good at. Our penalty rates is a perfect example of this. I have long believed, and people hold me to what I've said and printed over decades, so I always thought that being an atheist, I thought that Sunday rates should be the same as Saturday rates, and penalty rates, I think, hurt small business sometimes. But and so when the government announced, the Fair Works Commission said they're going to drop penalty rates from Sundays, and I thought, well, it was a Fair Work Commission, was brought in by the Labor government. It is an independent body. And they are the referee. So I went on Mitchell and said, oh, well, I think I agree with the government that they must stay out of this and let the Fair Work Commission make its decision. Then I started getting a lot of emails and material and input from people, from students who only work weekends, from women who sometimes only work on a Sunday. And I realised that just how much was going to hurt them. And so I voted with Labor on it. And I said, I changed my mind, but I said, I consulted, I know I said the umpire's decision should be final, but I then consulted the independent umpire, the video referee, and the video referee said, nah, we don't have it. And so I think penalty rates should stay.
Mm. You You're right. It's the only repeated thing I found in the whole book was about how hard work it is.
Well, I suppose it surprises me. People think, I go into my elevator, because we're not sitting at the moment, into my elevator at the apartment block, and somebody says, how are you enjoying your holiday?
Yeah.
Because if you're not in Canberra, you must be on leave. Yeah. You know? Now, I spent last Friday and Saturday and Sunday in Dandenong, Cowes, San Remo, just chatting to people. You know, I go around the markets, I know every DFO in Victoria, you know. And it's very funny, actually, because we said once a month I go country. I know the difference between rural and regional. You know, and so we went Bendigo and then up to Mildura. And I walked on one police chief. They think, hey, I'm going to walk in with a TV camera over my shoulder, which scares the hell out of them. But he said to me, well, what's wrong? I said, no, let's come and have a chat. And he said, I haven't seen a senator in my office in 8 years. Yeah. He's a police chief and the mayor.
Yeah.
And he said, well, I said, well, just here to have a chat and see what your moans are and your groans are. And it's something I've said I'd do, and we do. And during the election, we had what we call the Justice Bus. We had a JACO that we covered 11,250 kilometres around Victoria. And because most senators are just part of the party ticket. You wouldn't have a clue who half your senators are in Victoria, you know, and they're on the ticket. I mean, they screwed me because I got, according to the Electoral Commission, I got a 6-year term, right? That's under the Bob Hawke fairness system. But after double dissolution, don't worry, we checked the Constitution.
I bet
it's
you did.
Up to the Senate to decide who gets 3 years and who gets 6 years.
Yes. Oh, got the short straw, did you?
I got the short straw. This is how they do it. The Liberal government, the coalition government, said to Labor, look, let's do this sort of deal. What's the deal? Scott Ryan, who's a Liberal, was meant to get 3 years. He's now the president of the Senate, actually. And they said, Labor, if you support us giving Scott Ryan the 6 years, and we'll give Hinch 3 years in Victoria, we'll screw Lee Rhiannon up in New South Wales. And so Lee Rhiannon, who should be getting 6 years for the Greens, gets 3. And I think it's Senator O'Neill gets the 6. And so they had a vote on it in the Senate. And I think the Greens, about 12 of us voted against it. And on my office wall, I have a picture of me being, I was a scrutineer with like 12 of us on one side and 70 on the other side, sort of thing. And we got done. But so it means I have to, and I will stand again next year.
Right. You'll be 75.
I will be 75. Yes.
The
oldest senator I think ever elected.
Yeah, for the actual at election. Yeah. That's at what, 73.
Well, like Strom Thurmond was a senator in America, and he was 96. So I got tons of time. I got another 3 terms. Yeah. Oh, by the way, 2 things I got to tell you. A, we don't get a pension, all right? All that snout's in the trough. If you're elected after 2004, you don't get a pension, number one. Number two, we don't get frequent flyer points anymore. They've changed all that too. All right? And number three, I took a pay cut to do this job, all right? But I was out at a Shepparton market, and this old guy wanted to have I could tell he's going to have a go, right? So first of all, he said, oh, you got your snout's in the trough. You're just there for the pension. So I pointed out we didn't get a pension. And then I said, then he went on about frequent flyer points. So I pointed out we don't get frequent flyer points. Then I said to him, why don't you ask me why I fly business class? He said, yeah, why don't you fly domestic? I said, I do fly domestic, but I don't fly economy. He said, why don't you fly economy? He said, why do you fly business class? I said, because Virgin doesn't have a first class. And he shook his head about that, and his wife said, come on, Dennis, and off. And off they tootled. You know. I didn't say because I'd go and sit in a plane next to people like you, but I left that go.
You obviously, you're loving it. It seems like you are really thriving in this new bear pit.
Well, look, it's to jump the shark at my age and do something totally different. When I've bagged politicians.
Mind you were in jail for your 70th birthday.
Well, that's,
you're clearly like mixing it up, right?
Well, that is true. That's so true. Well, they're just re-chopping down all the trees and things around the Senate, the most disgusting thing they're doing for all the new security stuff there. And I went out of a photograph taken with Richard Di Natale sitting on a chopped down tree stump. And as we had to move a wire gate out of the way to get to the stump, he said, oh, quick, better quickly. He said, you know, we might get arrested. I said, mate, happens a lot. I've done it. It's no big deal, you know. it is an honour, A, to even stand. And then I had 220,000 people voted for me, you know. And I think Scott Ryan got 77 on his below the line ticket, but never mind.
Who's counting?
But it is, it's fantastic. And you can achieve stuff. Yep. Now, I would hate to have been wouldn't have liked to have been a senator, especially a minor party senator, say when Malcolm Fraser had control of both houses, because they wouldn't give you the time of day. Mm. Now they need you. And so they come after you, and you don't horse trade, but you know they've got to think long and hard before they get you.
Well, you're
the
holding out at the moment, aren't you, on the government's
tax.
Corporate? Yeah.
Look, personally, I think company tax cuts should be in. Now the government wants it for everybody to 30% down to 25%. Labor says they'll scrap anything over 2 million if your turnover is more than 2 million, which hurts small business. Last year, Jackie Lambie wanted to get up to 10 million, and I agreed to that. Then Pauline Hanson and I said to negotiate with Cormann and said that we think we can get it to 50 million, which they did. So they got a start. Mm. Now they want to go open slather for everybody. And my problem is, and I've said to Senator Cormann and the Treasurer only last month, I said, look, why don't you go to 500 million? Companies up to 500 million. Exclude the banks for now, because there's a banking royal commission going on at the moment. Every day the papers show how they've screwed workers for their mortgages and for loans. And even if I found out since all this happened that if you go and buy a car from a car yard, and the guy says to you, okay, do you want me to arrange the finance? Yes, that'd be nice. I can get you a good deal with such and such a bank. That's nice. Now, the bank's rate, I'm making this up, the bank's rate maybe say they want to do a deal at 5%. If he can get you to pay 5.6%, he gets a cash sling from the bank. You never know that you've been screwed. And now, how can you have banks getting a 5% tax cut when that sort of stuff's going on? You know, there's services today in the news that they weren't even providing. And they said, we can't explain why we weren't providing this, but we're charging people for it. So at the moment, I'm saying they should go to 500 million. And the PM said last week, I'm keen on this to go the whole hog. We'll take it to the election. Well, take it to the election. Mm. I've learned one thing in Canberra, and I threw this back at the government the other day about company tax. I said, I've learned, I think you may have told me, 70% of something is better than 100% of nothing. And so sometimes you have to compromise. And that's what I do with penalty rates. You've got to sometimes change your mind and say, this is wrong or this is right.
You just mentioned Jackie Lambie. There's a charming photo of the two of you at the midwinter ball in the book. You're even colour coordinated.
Was that deliberate? Yes. You can keep secrets in Canberra. Weeks we kept that secret. There were going to be dates at the ball. And on the night it happened, the word almost leaked, and the Australian journalist called my EA, I don't have a PA now, I have an EA, executive assistant, and said, we've heard rumours that Darren's bringing Jackie to the ball. And she said, that's right, wrong Jackie. They thought that Jackie Weir was going to make a surprise appearance.
It was delightful. And look, your buddies on the crossbench are falling like flies at the moment. Yeah. Are you missing them?
I thought Nick Xenophon, his departure was bizarre because he was very powerful and very skillful. You know, beware of Greek seeking gifts. He's very good at it. But when you think of it, they originally it was... I was the one they wanted. There's a guy called John Coleman who's a constitutional nerd who hated Section 44, wanted to prove how bad it was.
Is this the Perth lawyer?
Perth lawyer, yeah. And I didn't know until I read in The Australian a few days later that he said, I thought I'd get Hinch because he's a journo. He wouldn't know. He'd be sloppy. And then I thought, Scott Ludlam's also in New Zealand. I wanted to get both of those. It turns out Ludlam was not clean. I'd taken all the precautions. Then Waters went over, and then Nash, then Barnaby, and then Alexander, then Guy Kokoschky-Moore. Gallagher's in trouble. Lamb's going to be in trouble. And ironically, One Nation tried to say that I was illegal because I was an American.
That's right.
Because I have a social security number. So I called up Brandis and I called up Penny Wong and said, I'll go to the High Court if I have to, if that's what you think I need to do. And he called me back on a Saturday and said, I've talked to the Solicitor General and no, you're clean. We don't think you need to go to the High Court. You're safe. And that was the day I was actually going to Sydney for a radio reunion at the Lord Nelson Hotel, a famous old pub. And I walked in and they all start singing Aussie, 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 oi, 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 and all this sort of stuff. And I said... I'm so pleased, and you won't be able to see this, I said, I'm going to shout the bar. I said, I'm so pleased I'm going to shout the bar. And I dug deep into my pocket. And somewhere in here, if I keep digging deep in my pocket, and I put the, I put that on the bar.
Oh, it is. It's an American dollar.
No.
$100.
$100.
Wow. Keep it nice. Oh, that's a beautiful little greenback.
$125 would be worth, wouldn't it now?
Yeah, at least. I think at least. I felt like Jackie Lambie, she was here a few weeks ago at the Fifth Estate. And
did you know she has the foulest mouth of any person, male or female, I've ever met in my life?
I spent a good half an hour in the green room with her. And but she was somebody who she is really missing it, you can tell. Yeah. And she's very open about it. How did you feel in those hours where it could have been taken away from you?
It scared me. It scared me. I thought, especially when the American thing came up, I thought, hang on, I can't vote in America. I can't live there without the right visa. I can't ever do this or that. So it must be clean. But the fact was, if you have a social security number, it's there forever. You cannot get rid of it. It's yours until you die. I also made sure that before I took office, I wrote to the Americans and said, if I'm due for a pension, I don't want it. So I excluded myself from American pension just in case. I think I don't know how we're going to change it, because you'll never get through a referendum that makes life easier for politicians. So that's not going to happen. But this thing about making money from the Crown, it's bizarre. I mean, the fact that one of my candidates last time around, he had to quit the police force to run federally. Yeah. He's now running for me in the state and doesn't have to quit.
Yeah.
I could not be, and you feel good about this, I could not be Premier of Victoria, because I could not be elected in Victoria because of my criminal record. But because I've done the wording and the way it's worked in Canberra, I've done my time and I'm clean. If I was on a suspended sentence or something like that, then I would not be able to stand.
Well, the point of all this too is you've got to be across the detail. And well, I was delighted in the book that I had at least one friend in the where I've said throughout the whole saga, which I kind of loved. I said this time and again.
I have no sympathy for them. None.
Like, you know, and I thought, well, if they all go and we just have to start again, so be it.
I'm sure we've had at least one Prime Minister who is illegal.
Which one?
Is there Watson way back?
Yeah.
I think
Labor Party.
Yeah, I think Watson was actually born in Chile and never something like that, and then went to Canada. Well, what's his name? Mackenzie. He was Canadian, American. God knows what he was.
None of them were born in Australia at the beginning, were they? They were all imported. It's a mystery.
If you can't do that, what's it, Bob Hawke's line? If you can't run your party, you can't run the country. Yeah. Well, if you don't even know what the rules are to get elected, you don't deserve to be there. We agree.
Oh, I love that. if you have got a question for Darren, put your hand up and somebody will put a microphone in it.
Darren, you're on the Parliamentary Committee for a federal anti-corruption body.
Yes.
How's that progressing?
I think we should have one. I think it should be a national ICAC. And as part of our deliberations, we went to Queensland and saw what they do up there, and we saw what happened. I mean, we've only got a sort of a Clayton's one here in Victoria. And I think it should be called a national ICAC, not a national integrity commission. I think it should be a national ICAC, because people know what ICAC is these days now. They know that it can be, and it has worked at some stages, especially, I think, in New South Wales. Which reminds me there once, you remember once here in Victoria, they've changed the name, I can't remember what it is now, but they're originally going to call it the Police Integrity Commission. The Police Integrity Group, that's what they're going to call it. The Police Integrity Group. Somebody realised that the acronym wasn't that nice for policemen. PIG. so then they changed it. But I think the National ICAC is overdue, and I'm glad to see that the Labor opposition has now come around fully in favour of it, and the Greens are too, so I think we're getting closer to it.
Hi, my name's Mel. I'm down from Sydney to see you. I've heard you on radio many a time and you sound just like you do on radio. My question is a general one and almost probably impossible to answer, but what's the answer for politicians who go in with good intention and then are almost forced to compromise their ideals to make deals to stay there, etc. I don't know if I worded that very
Yes, you
well.
Have. Yeah, in fact,
pretty clear,
in
isn't
fact,
it? Yeah.
That is, you're from Sydney, that is a Neville Rann question. Premier Neville Rann, he said, you start out with such ideals, you're so idealistic. He said, by the time you get to the top, you're so covered in muck and dirt, you forget the reason you got into there in the first place. And that is very sad. Somebody asked me what would happen to me if that sort of thing happened, and I said, I think I've been around long enough, and I've got enough friends and colleagues and enemies around me to remind me, if they see me going down that track, to pull me up and say, hey, Darren, that's not what you're there for, that's not what you promised, and I hope that I can stick to that. There was even thing over the company tax at one stage. I thought, if I do go for vote for the whole hog now, with the banks being so on the nose and being so undeserving, I thought I could be voted out the next election. But if that's it, that's the case, so be it. That's what people decide. They decide you've made a decision. If it's the wrong one, they think it's the wrong one, they'll vote you out. And that's the point of it. But you're quite right that you do make those compromises, or people do. And that's why I don't think I could ever be part of the Liberal Party or the Labor Party. The Labor Party, I think, with the CFMEU now, even though I voted for the union to amalgamate, I think they have too much power in the Labor Party, and I wouldn't be comfortable with that. And I think there's too many people on the Liberal side who are lawyers and silver spoons into the manor born, which I don't like. The problem you've got is that so many people in Canberra are almost professional politicians. They come up through, they work in the... They work for a politician, and they're one of his or her offsiders, and they just think our time will come. On the Labor Party, you get to be a union boss. Sometimes you've been a union boss for 30 years, and I don't think you have the life experiences. I'm hoping that with my background, because you're a journalist, you've covered so many things over the decades that you at least get a grasp of what's happening. Oh, that's my theory, and I hope it works.
Yeah, mine too.
Thanks, Derry. In your opinion, what would it take for the federal government and opposition to take a bipartisan approach to matters of national strategic importance?
They won't. They're not to the manner born. I mean, they'll do it, okay. They did it this week over Syria, over the chemical warfare there, and they will do it. They do it even though some members of the Labor Party don't like the idea of the shadow ministry supports the government on offshore detention. But I think it would only be, I think, in matters of war, or maybe we saw, I suppose, with the global financial crisis, the Libs weren't at all happy when Rudd did the $900 salvage route, and they still complain about it. So I hate to be pessimistic, but I think it'd be very rare. Have to be a matter of war or national disaster, and they do come together in national disasters, but I think it'd have to be that sort of situation before you'd find bipartisanship. Mm. Not the answer you'd want, but I'm sorry.
Darren, I'm up the back.
Right.
I'm wondering if you could give us an update on the theft of the billions of litres of water from the Murray...
The Murray, darling, that is one of the to city people, they don't understand that. But and this is where the Xenophon team are very strong about it. The theft of water from the Murray Darling is a national scandal, and I know that, and that's why I supported the old South Australian government, the last one, who are going to have a royal commission, state royal commission, into the theft. There's questions that. That Barnaby Joyce says, this is not get Barnaby, but some of the things have gone on with the Murray Darling water is a national disgrace, and I think you haven't seen even the start of the end of it. Okay.
Hi, Darren. My name's Lisa Bentley, and I have a question. You mentioned about the state parliament and that you were running someone this election. Do you believe that you're going to have the party registered in time?
Yes, I do. I think we have to have 500 registered, and we've got the 500, but then the VEC then starts questioning you, and the emails have to come back from the people to prove that they're all legitimate. We're standing 16 candidates in the upper house. That's two in each region. I think we've got a reasonably good chance of picking up two seats in the upper house. We'll stand probably in three or four lower house seats, and our chances are very slim, really slim. But I've got Stuart Grimley is a guy who is my he stood with me last time federally. He's standing in Western Regional, and a former mayor of Maribyrnong, and that is Catherine Cumming, who's been an independent councillor for 20 years, has joined the Justice Party, and she's standing for me in Western Metropolitan. And she's very persuasive. She even got me to join the Bulldogs AFLW team, and they won about a month later.
Hello, Darren. Yep. My name's Michelle Swagerman. I was wondering how scared you are about the direction that some of the electoral reform bills are taking us in terms of people's political voice and journalists' freedom. I'm talking about the Foreign Donation Bill, the Espionage Bill, and the Foreign Influence Bill.
Well, the Foreign Donations Bill, that's still way up in the air, and I agree with Bill Shorten on this one and the Greens. I've met with people from various charities because the threat to charities, I mean, it's designed, I believe, by the government to try and get up, but it's other real genuine charities are going to be really hurt by this. On the journalists, that's... I still haven't been convinced by the government that the protections, enough protections are there. And one thing that we've been hammering on a lot of the crossbench, and that's over whistleblowers. And there's not enough whistleblower protection there as yet. We're still a long way from that being finalised, because there's about five or six threads there which I'm not convinced of, and it'll still be some time before that gets anywhere near being passed, I would think. But the foreign charities one is really, really scaring some of the people there. So one of my other issues this year, a big one, is I know I've said for years, and I have to stop saying it soon because I am old, I say the only difference between old people and me was that they got there first, right? And I think now, so I'm at the one end, we've got looking at at family courts and handling of kids, but the other end, aged care. I'm working with the registered nurses, because aged care in this country is an abomination. We need more better ratios of aged care. I mean, they say, especially now there's so many private, huge companies making so much money. I mean, I had two nurses in my office last week, and I thought that they're spending, the average was $6.30 a day on food per person, it's $6.08. I ate better than that in jail. I ate far better than that in jail, than what pensions are getting. And they now say things like, our ratio is 7-1. That includes the guy who mows the lawn. That includes the guy who cuts the hedges, who wouldn't see a person in a nursing home in his life. So that's going to be a big push next month by nurses around the country. So watch out for that, because it affects all of us, because you've all got family who are going to be there. We're all going to get there one day, and that's fine. Some of those things, some of the way people are treated is just not right.
One more. Time for one last.
Yeah, down the front.
G'day, Darren. Could you give us an update on what's going on in health, the private health insurance reforms?
Well, the biggest scandal of that is the fact, and I don't know why, having brought it in, why the Labor opposition is fighting the Medicare levy. That is for the NDIS. That's going to fund it. And I know this is not a totally popular view, but even if you're earning $30,000 a year and you have to pay for an extra $4 for the NDIS, it could affect your family. And if you, the more you earn, the more you're going to pay. It wasn't funded. It wasn't funded by the Labor government at the time. I think it's one of the greatest. It's still got a hell of a lot of holes in it, but at least it's moving somewhere down the right way. So, the most horrible thing would be if you're 65, 70 years of age, and you've got a 40-year-old handicapped child, you think, I may die in the next 10 years. What the hell's going to happen to my son? What's going to happen to my daughter? So that's one area. The other area is because we haven't got the best system yet, you may be 25 years old, you're female, and you're brain damaged in a car accident. The places you are put are nightmarish. So there's a whole lot of areas still there, but the NDIS is one that I'm very, very, very keen on. But you're talking about health, increases in health, private health insurance. Well, ironically, we sound now saying it's like, I think this year's 4.6% or something. That's one of the lowest we've had in years, but it still means it's got to the stage now over the last 15 years that people by the ton are opting out of private health insurance. They figure they can't afford it, and they'll take the risk. And that's got stuff up written all over it, because that just clogs the public hospitals even more. And I don't know the answer to that. I think governments have to be even tougher, and maybe some of the rebates have to be cut, and then that'll force it up even more. I know that is a problem. That's not a very good answer.
Pity our time's up, isn't it? On that note, yeah. No, it's been a pleasure to meet you, Darren, and I'm glad you're there. After reading the book and talking to you, I am really glad you're there, and I hope you stick around and get another 6 years, and that'll be 9, and you'll be in your 80s, and you'll be, I'm sure, as sharp as ever, well, actually.
Can I say one thing? I never dreamed you'd have so many people would be here tonight. I really didn't. So thank you for coming. I'm thrilled to be here and honoured to be here. And I'll leave you with one line that I've used several times in the past, and that is that I'm living proof that you can't kill weeds, you can't kill noxious weeds, and you can't kill obnoxious weeds. Thank you. Thank you.
Darren Hinch in conversation with Sally Warhaft there for The Fifth Estate. We'll be back in a couple of weeks, but if you still want more, you'll find other episodes as well as videos of our talks at wheelercentre.com. Until next time, take care.